Thanks for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. If you're new here, there's a price for the show. You have to share it with a friend or family member if you get something out of today's episode. And I'm guessing you're going to get something out of today's episode because it's all about education today.
And all about survival.
Survive.
Survive.
Survive the things.
So, all I can think of is Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, survive. Survive.
Speaking of, yes, survival. Our guest today is John Turner. He is a former Marine infantryman. He was an infantryman for about 4 years between 03 and 07. Multiple combat deployments there, transitioned out, and he is now the founder and, I guess, instructor at Accipiter Fieldcraft and the owner of Wild Roots Community Farm, which they do some pretty interesting stuff. Really excited to hear about what you do, John.
Excited to jump in. Thanks for joining us today, brother.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and after we just wrapped up a nice, easy little 6.5 mile hike this morning.
It was actually 7.13.
Oh. I was way off. Yeah.
But, you know, the infantryman told us that.
Not me.
Our first TAC event at Terra Arma, we're doing these community events where we bring out anyone who wants to participate to do some local hiking with us. So thanks for coming out to do that with us today.
Dude, super excited. That was a great hike and a super awesome group of folks there. So
Yeah, it was great. And we love these kind of events because I feel like something we're really lacking in today's society is that community feel, right?
Yep.
So getting out there, getting some sun, it was a beautiful day. That was awesome. We had an opportunity to meet at MCON last year.
Yes.
So that was absolutely great to see you reconnect. We're talking about your kids being a fan of the show.
Yeah, dude. we've been listening to you guys for a long while, and I think one of the reasons it's important for them is like they get to hear other stories of people who've been through various life circumstances from a different angle. And you guys bring a humor to it, which is awesome. But there's the serious side of things as well. And so, like, you know, I've been through a lot. We've all been through a lot. I know there's people who've been through worse than me and worse than us. But I think that the more they can gain perspective from other people's stories, the better off it's going to be for them, because that's what's going to make them resilient in the longer term. They understand that, you know, it's not just isolated with one individual who has a difficult day from here to there, but it's like there's a collective people who have been through a lot of things, and they might not know how to process that. And through the storytelling and through the things that they do on a day-to-day, they can see that. And my boys, man, they eat that up. And so it's actually been super really important for me to share the stories that you guys share with them, so they have a better understanding of who I am as an individual as well.
I love that
approach.
That's
beautiful. When you think about it, I when you first came up to me when we were at MCON and you said that, it's like, thanks for giving us an avenue of educating my children. It's just such a great approach. I didn't even think about, you know?
Yeah.
So beautiful. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. Let's rewind it back and talk a little bit about you and how you got started. And what inspired you to join the military? Was it family? Was it college money? Was it sense of service?
I think it was mostly family and sense of service. I've had a family member in every war going back to the Revolution. And from a very young age, you know, my dad was stationed up at Westover Air Force Base in Massachusetts. And we spent a lot of time going on base. And I was just always intrigued by the planes and people in BDUs and all that stuff. And when the first soldiers were coming home from Desert Shield and Desert Storm, we were there in the hangar to greet them. And I just remember like watching this mass of people flood into the hangar, and they're all wearing their chocolate chips and just being totally enamored by it. And that was like the solidifying moments, like, yes, this is what I want to do. And they're all different people, shapes and sizes, but there's something about seeing them come in with their gear, drop the gear, meet their families. I was just like, that's it for me. And so from there on, you know, it's just, I always knew. And then 9/11 happened when I was in high school, and like, that was it. It was like, yeah, I want to go fight.
Kind of locked it in for you.
For sure.
Yeah. That makes sense. So you graduated around, you said 9/11 happened during your high school career. So I'm assuming you graduated shortly after?
Yeah. 2003. And I was in boot camp a month later.
Wow. Okay. So quick turn.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So you had a couple of years where you're waiting in high school, just ready to go.
I was itching.
Did that distract you from successfully completing high school? Like, I remember for me, like, same thing. Recruiters would come in, you know, they come in. I knew I wanted to join the military for years as well. And junior and senior year were just so distracting because I knew I was just going to leave.
Yeah, I mean, it was a distraction, but I knew that in order to get to point B, I had to go through all the nonsense in between point A and there. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I didn't want anything else other to do than just be a grunt, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, like, I was kind of a recruiter's wet dream. I walked in the office in between my junior and senior year, said, I want to go now. And they're like, you can't do that. At the time, the Army was allowing folks to go through basic training in between their junior and senior year. So I was kind of hoping I can jump on that train with the Marine Corps, but it wasn't the case.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, neither have I.
Yeah, that's wild. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
So I don't know all the details, but there's a couple of folks that were in my school. They were going to go into the Army, and so they had some program lined up where they could actually go to basic training between their junior and senior year because it was only 8 weeks. I don't know if they still do that. Oh. It sounds like they don't.
Yeah.
But the Marine Corps definitely wasn't offering that.
They were just trying to turn and burn people for after 9/11, I'm sure.
I know ROTC does a similar program, or you know, some officer candidacy courses.
Junior ROTC.
Yeah, they do similar things where, like, when you're in college, you'll go to your basic training between your sophomore and junior year, whatever it is. But that's interesting. I had no idea that was a program. I don't know how I feel about it.
I just can imagine, you know, those kids coming back and just being absolute tools on their senior degree.
I'm a veteran.
I'm a veteran. Oh, man. So Marine Corps, it was always Marine Corps for you then?
No. Okay. Actually, originally I wanted to be a pilot. And then actually Danny and I were talking about this on the trail today. I went to go see an optometrist when I was like 10, 11 years old. Mm. And he was like, your left eye's lazy. You'll never be a fighter pilot. And it just like crushed my dreams. Ugh. And so went and then was kind of like looking at the whole Ranger SF route because those were the books that were available. Mm-hmm. Right. And Rambo was a predominant figure in my life growing up. And that seemed like the most logical thing to do. But my brother graduated boot camp when I was 16. I remember going down to the island. Paris Island and seeing the obstacle course and watching all these boots just get hazed. And that was it. I was it's like, that looks very hard and I want to do it. So
rise to the challenge, huh?
Absolutely.
I love that. So you leave for basic training.
Yep.
I'm sure you make it through all that. Okay. And where's your first duty station at?
Yeah. So went through boot camp, squad leader, got meritoriously promoted, which was good because I was kind of a numbnuts before I went to boot camp, you know, but, did that, went through infantry training, and then ended up in my unit on Friday the 13th in February. And 2 weeks later, we went to Haiti for 4 months.
Wow.
So it was a quick turnaround from like boot camp to infantry training to being in a line unit and going.
So 6 months out of high school, you're on your first deployment.
Yep, 18.
That's a quick turn.
Yeah.
So what were you guys doing in Haiti?
So my understanding is that there's an American-backed coup to overthrow the president. Mm-hmm. That's what I was told by some people who had done some like relief work in Haiti. What I do know is that the president was no longer in power and the Haitian people were pretty upset by that. And at that time, it was one of two he was one of two presidents that had either not been assassinated or kicked out by the people.
Wow.
So they were upset. For whatever reason, they brought in our unit as a QRF and we were there to keep the peace. Mm. And it ended up turning into a 4 month workup to Iraq.
Okay.
So.
Mm. Okay. And you were right out to Iraq pretty close after that.
Yeah. So once we got back in June of 2004, at that time, our sister unit 1-8 had taken our place. And so they ended up pushing through Phantom Fury and second push of Fallujah. And we replaced them in January of 2005. So we got back in June, left in January.
Okay. And how was that deployment for you?
It was mild. I think we only had about 11 KIA and I think less than 100 wounded.
It's so interesting, you know, hearing this from a Marine's perspective because 11 KIA is a lot. You know, that's a lot of people.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
in the grand scheme of things, I get what you're saying. It's just spoken like an infantryman, you know, it's just, you know, when you walk away with, you know, just a squad less, it's still a lot, but,
it's a lot.
But it just goes to show you the scale of how rough it was in the beginning.
Yeah, man. I mean, that was legit. And, you know, I know we were talking about quick turnaround for me going from high school to Haiti. Like most of my friends, they went from high school to Fallujah.
Yeah.
You know,
and much different.
It is, you know, and it's one of those things where that's always kind of eating at me, but it's like, that wasn't where I was supposed to be. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think as an infantryman, you train and you do these workups and like your job is to do the thing, right? Mm-hmm. And when you don't get to do the thing, you're upset by it, mm-hmm. you know, but without really understanding the cost of that thing in the process.
100%.
And I think that touches the statement that you just made about like 11 people is actually, that's a squad less.
Yeah.
You know, but I think for any young person, like it doesn't really register. It didn't click to me that we were actually at war until about halfway through my third deployment. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. It wasn't when like we lost four from a pressure plate. It wasn't when my buddy got shot. It was like when I heard my other buddy screaming, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so it's like, why is that the mechanism to where all of a sudden war is real?
Yeah, it's, you know, just, and we talk about this extensively. Yeah. And I think the conclusion we draw is it becomes real when those in your life are affected.
Yeah.
And for me, the moment was real on my second deployment when I lost my first buddy.
Yeah.
You know, and it is. I mean, that is the collateral damage of war, is seeing people go down. But I think when you have a personal affiliation towards that, yeah. that's when it gets really difficult.
For
and
sure.
war becomes real for, and then we start questioning, right? What are we doing here?
Like, yeah.
Why are we here?
Yep.
And let's just try to get everybody back home in one piece and home safe, you know?
And that was precisely the moment where I was just like, what are we doing? Like, 'cause I really don't understand this mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we're going out into these spaces where yes, there's people laying IEDs and setting up, you know, mortar areas. But it's just like
they're doing it because we're here.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Like yeah. it sometimes it just doesn't make sense. It's like the only thing that makes sense, and then it doesn't make sense at all, you yeah. know. But yeah. that's the nature of the beast, right?
And that's it's impossible to describe what you just said right yeah. there. But that feeling is true and it's innate, and I think most people with multiple combat deployments feel that way.
Yeah.
The first one, piss and vinegar, right? We're excited yeah. to be there, go do the job. Mm-hmm. It's fun. Even if you're losing people, like you're still out there to do the job. I don't know what the mechanism that causes us to realize later. Maybe it's just age and wisdom
yeah.
and, you know, starting to realize that this war was a little bit different than the other wars. But,
yeah.
you know, at a certain point, you do come to that realization, like, wait, what are we actually doing here? And I think the military has done a really good job at avoiding, you know, keeping people from not asking that question, right?
Sure.
I don't know what the mechanism is there either. They do a really good job of
yeah.
making you not ask that question.
Yep.
And two, I think another huge point to touch on is it all depends on your leadership.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Biggest thing for me is we made a joke towards the end of our second deployment of our envisioning our leaders with a dart and a map of Afghanistan and just throwing it out there and saying, what ribbon can I get today? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is unfortunate, to see that a lot of these bad officers out there are trying to impress their chain of command, whatever it is. I mean, we had a story, a guest on, and you might've heard it, where, the guy lost both of his legs. Because his officer was just like, let's go do bounding exercises outside the wire. And they just bounded into a IED.
Right, in front of a major who he was showcasing these bounding exercises to. Walked out there to show off to the major.
Dude, I don't understand the logic behind that one bit, man.
Doesn't make sense.
And that's the thing, too, is so... So we have a tendency to say, you know, big army, big Marines, wherever it is like, what's wrong with you? But sometimes it's just one or two above us.
Yeah.
Yeah. That are trying to make their debut.
Yeah, sure.
If you will.
The understanding that the decisions you make here will affect other people.
Yeah.
That's it. Plain and simple. The decisions you make here will affect other people for the remainder of their lives or end them.
How about you're at war? You should have already done your bounding exercises.
Are we here to train or fight? Let's figure it out, boys.
I think, you know, for me, and I'm sure you could say the same thing, everybody can, is when you're downrange, you're deployed, especially as an infantryman, that's vacation.
Yeah. Yeah, because there is absolutely a lot of downtime. And, you know, the workup to that moment is very rigorous, and it should be. Mm-hmm. But, dude, if you're not pushing missions out or, you know, doing some kind of post, you know, because that was the other side of our, of what we had to do. Then you're just throwing rocks, or you're working out, or you're eating MREs, and that's it, man. It's just like, you're either working or you're working out, you know? So
fat camp. I love it.
Yeah. Fat camp.
So you briefly mentioned that on this deployment, or the third deployment, you, your buddies were hit by an IED. Four went down?
Yeah, April 2nd of 2006.
Okay. Are you comfortable sharing what that day looked like?
Yeah, so I wasn't out on that mission, but I just remember, I remember finally waking up because we had to go on post. So how it worked at the Gov Center is that we'd have like an 8-day cycle where we would be there running post. So it was like 6 hours on, 7 hours off, 7 hours on, 6 hours off. Mm-hmm. And we did that for 8 days. And then we go into a patrol cycle where we'd be patrolling for 4 to 8 days, depending. So it'd be like ground patrols and like foot patrols, or mounted, depending on what we were tasked to do. And then there would be like a rest period, which would be just filling sandbags. And so we were on our post cycle, and 3rd Platoon was out on their patrol cycle.
Introducing Bubs Naturals, a lifestyle brand inspired by the legacy of Navy SEAL Glenn Bub Doherty. Born out of a commitment to adventure, wellness, and giving back, Bubs offers a range of nature-derived nutritional products designed to help you live life to the fullest. From their flagship collagen peptides, packed with over 20 grams of protein per serving, to their functional creamers with MCT oil for sustained energy all day long, each Bubs product is crafted with care and quality. What sets Bubs apart? Well, with every purchase, Bubs donates 10% of their profits to charity through the Glenn Doherty Memorial Foundation. They support special operators and their families as they transition into civilian life. Join the Bubs community today and fuel your adventures with purpose. Visit BubsNaturals.com to learn more. And be sure to use code MEDEVAC for 20% off your first order. That's MEDEVAC, all capital letters, when checking out at BubsNaturals.com.
And we just got woken up, and I went to go check in with the COC, and my buddy Hootie comes out, and he's all sad. I'm just like, what's up, dude? And he's like, can't talk about it. And I'm just like, all right, whatever. And so I go smoke a cigarette, come back, and he's still like all pissed off. And I kind of like nudged him a little bit more. And he's like, dude, we just, you know, we took 4 KIA, or we had 4 KIA. And in my mind, it registered as, oh, we just killed 4 of the enemy. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, that's a good thing. No. And he's like, no, dude, we took 4 KIA. And I was just like, well, that's not good. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, we were, the patrol was north of the city. Humvee hit a pressure plate. It was a quad stack, 155s. Mm. And they found the 50 cal on part of the Humvee, you know, a couple stories up, 100 meters down. It was a big one. And one of the dudes actually survived that, which is what I can't understand. So there's 5 people in the truck, 4 got killed. You know, one was the platoon sergeant, one was the corpsman, one was a squad leader, and the other was...
Was the gunner? Did the gunner survive?
No.
No? So it was someone in the truck that survived?
Yeah, the driver survived.
Interesting. Wow.
Which I don't know how.
That's so wild.
Yeah, and even then, like, war just didn't click with me. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. just like, we still pushed out. You know, and at that time in Ramadi, you know, things were starting to get pretty spicy. That was beginning of April, mm-hmm. and we were just out pushing missions, mm-hmm. going out for ambushes and overwatches and all that. And then my buddy got shot in the head, took a sniper round. And then still didn't click, dude, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's like a couple months later, you know, there's some mortars. We started taking some 120s in on the roof. And I just turned around and I watched Post 10 get hit. And I just remember seeing this plume of smoke. And then like, you know, 300 meters away, I just hear Howard screaming. I'm just like, what the fuck, dude? You know, how is, you know? And that was it, man. That was the point, you know, 2.5 years or... 3 years into my enlistment and like on my third deployment, where it's just like, oh, we're at war. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know? And at that point, it's like, it doesn't matter if you believe in war, if you believe in peace, none of that shit really matters, because it doesn't, what makes sense is getting those dudes home and mm-hmm. doing everything you can. Like being an infantryman, being a ranger, being, you know, some dude on a search and rescue team, CSAR, whatever. It's like, that's your job, mm-hmm. you know, but the purpose of your job is who's next to you. And their families, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so...
Get him home. Get him home safe. So this reality kind of sinks in with you on your third deployment, correct?
Yeah.
And it any other hairy situations at that point, or was did the deployment kind of close out and you're heading home?
No, I mean, after Howard got hit, I got hit a couple weeks later. I took a piece of shrapnel in my neck from a mortar blast. And I think at that point, we had, I think, just like a month left.
Okay.
And was that on the FOB? Or?
Yeah, so that was at the government center. Howard got hit beginning of August. And then I was on August 18th. And same thing, like woke up, we were on our post cycle at the same time. So woke up, smoked a cigarette, went, took a leak, came back, sat on my bed. And then like the first round hit on the top of the roof. And I just kind of like jokingly looked down my watch. It's like, oh yeah, they're late, because it was after the last prayer call. And we can assume every day that like during the last prayer call, you know, we would take rounds. Mm-hmm. And it was after that point. And then for whatever reason, man, I just like adjusted my posture, slouched. And then the round hit right outside the window, and I took a piece of shrapnel on my neck. And then the next day, I took an IED, and then had to go back on post. You know, so
what did that shrapnel look like?
It was just, dude, it was a small piece, but it was like quarter inch maybe from my carotid.
Okay,
wow,
yeah, lucky day.
Yeah.
So if you hadn't adjusted your posture, maybe it would have been a different story.
Probably, but wow. You know, for me, it's just it. You know, like. You were affected by a blast in a different way. I was affected by a blast in a different way. We all know people who've been affected by blasts in different ways, yeah. You know, and it's not, for me, it's just like, man, that is a tiny little, like merely a flesh wound, right?
Yeah.
In the grander scheme of things. But it's like, that just kind of made it more real, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the last of the deployment closed out, everything was good to go. And then we were on another workup for another deployment. And that's when I got medically discharged because of that and because of other physical stuff that was going on with my body. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was, did you have any intention or desire to reenlist beyond that?
Yeah,
or?
I actually had my papers like written up.
Okay.
When we were overseas, and then things just like changed.
Yeah.
And then the, you know, the Marine Corps kind of made the decision for me,
yeah,
which mm-hmm. was unfortunate, but like,
so you went through the med board process and what was the consensus there?
They discharged me for post-traumatic stress and TBI.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that this is a really common one too. And if you feel comfortable, I'd be curious to see kind of what they saw versus what you were feeling. Was it impeding your work? Were you irritable? Like, what was the...
Oh, yeah. I mean, all that, like, all the signs and symptoms were there.
Okay.
You know, I think, there's no denial of that. Like, there is definitely, like, increase of stress and increase of agitation, like, and all the things.
Anti-establishment, maybe a little, like, disregard authority.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Like, you know, sometimes you just slewed a little bit lower. Yeah. You know? But, you know, I think that... Could I have fought that? Probably. But the biggest issue is that during that time, I was on a cocktail of medications. Mm. You know, and this is when they were starting to introduce, because at that point, post-traumatic stress still wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Basically shell shock still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they were testing out all these medications. And it just threw me through this massive whirlwind that, you know, I wasn't able to think properly. Wasn't able to feel, wasn't able to dream, wasn't able to sleep. And like, this is what it's supposed to be helping me with. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's always been my issue, man. It's like, you're going to teach these folks how to go to war, how to do their job, and you're not going to teach them how to come home.
Yeah.
And that's been the biggest issue. You know, that's why so many vets fucking kill themselves every day, because they don't have some kind of support network in place, you know? And since 2005, like 25 dudes from my unit have taken their own lives. Mm. We actually had the first dude from our unit kill himself in a porta potty in Iraq in 05.
Wow.
You know? And so it's one of those things where, yes, like I'm open about the whole mental health side of things, because I think it needs to be discussed. I've been at that point where that seemed to be the only logical option. But at the end of the day, man, it's like, I don't want to be a statistic. I don't want to prove them to be right.
Yeah.
You know? And that for me, it gives me a good drive to like really like unfuck myself and get my shit together, so that way I could be a functional person in society for my family, for my kids, my wife, my future.
Yeah.
Like, I love life, man. Like, I love life. And I'm so grateful that everything that I've been through. I wouldn't change any of it, right? Mm-hmm. But I know that there's a lot of people like us who don't have those outlets that can get them to that point where yeah. they become this statistic, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. And I think you find yourself at a fork in the road.
Sure.
It's either let it break you or, you know, change you to becoming a better version of yourself.
Yeah.
I think that's the motivation. It's how we handle adversity.
Yeah.
Quite simply. So your transition out of the military was done kind of a little dirty. So I'm sure you had quite a bit of animosity towards the Marine Corps
yeah,
towards the end.
Absolutely I did. And was absolutely in a vulnerable place. And I had a lot of animosity towards it, man, mm-hmm. you know, because within the first 2 months of getting out, there's another person that I'd known that killed themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, dude, why are you letting this happen? Yeah. And it took me a number of years to really be like, well, it's a bigger organization. It's the cogs in the machine. They're not perfect, you know, but at some point it does fall down to the individual. Mm-hmm. And like you were just saying, it's like, you're at a fork in the road. You're going to choose which path you want to take. And, you know, misery is comfortable. And like,
it's true.
We've all been there, man, you know? So after that animosity, it was just like, all right, they're not going to do it for me. I got to do it. And started traveling around the country, you know, with this group of artists, and we were just making art and just like being with each other. Actually, we had a residency in San Antonio in 2009 at Southwest School of Art.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very so cool. What kind of art?
Making paper. Yeah. Out of uniforms.
Out of uniforms.
Yep.
Okay. You definitely need to dive into.
Dude, I got a lot of irons in the fire. So
yeah, this is interesting.
So this actually, that was one of the mechanisms for me to kind of like look at things differently. Right. Yeah. So you take this fabric, this thing that you wore at war, you know, whatever happened and it happened in it. And then you're deconstructing it and you're reforming it into this thing that makes sense to you. So you have this blank sheet of paper, you have this blank canvas, you just rewrote war essentially, or your perception of it. And then you go through, I learned how to set type for letterpress, like old school newspaper type stuff.
Yeah. So
actually setting individual pieces of lead type and then printing, like doing wood carvings and stuff like that. Dude, that became my drug that got me to like kind of clear my shit up.
So yeah. in the meantime, are you dealing with prescription medications as well? Or are you finding that you're weaning, you've weaned yourself off
completely? I smoked a lot of pot.
Yeah, well, that'll do it.
Yeah.
I get shut. This whole podcast is going to get shut down by Big Pharma now.
No more marijuana. Reefer madness.
Yeah. Marijuana got you out of the prescriptions? Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Surprise.
Right?
Damn.
So what year are you doing this? So you get out in 06 and you're...
Got out in 07.
07, excuse me. Yep. And you're doing this traveling... art exhibit or
more or less
traveling around the country?
Yeah, dude, we showed our work all around the country. Okay. And that's actually how I met my wife.
Okay.
We had a show up in Burlington and they were giving us like a 2 month period to be in this gallery. Mm-hmm. And we essentially moved the entire paper studio there and we treated it as we would our own studio. So we were there like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, just like drinking beers, making paper. All the drunkies are coming off of Church Street. Yeah. They're like knocking on the windows and we're just like cheersing them and all that. And we just made paper, man. And I showed up early for a tour of the print studio and met my wife.
Okay.
And that was back in 2009.
What was she doing?
She was the clay. She was the assistant clay studio manager for Burlington City Arts.
Interesting.
I showed up early. It's like the one time I showed up
early. She makes paper. You make clay.
Yeah.
This is great. Yeah, I love it. That's a good cute meat.
It is, man. And we kind of stalked each other for a little bit.
Sorry. I'm curious on how this love was struck. So did you have like the most beautiful paper to present to her? Here you are, my madam.
I made it with my finest cotton rag.
Yeah.
uniform.
Origami hearts out of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So, so you meet her through this and you guys hit it off and different states at that point.
No, we had shown all around the country, but we were actually finally showing in Vermont. Mm.
Okay.
And, it was in the city that we lived in at the beautiful time. And dude, it just worked out and like things moved really quick. A couple months later, I bought a Volkswagen van and like a 78 We traveled like 19,000 miles in 6 months together.
Wow.
Yeah, dude, it was like quick.
That's cool.
Yeah.
You just drive around the country to enjoy it?
Yeah.
And that had to be so cathartic as well. Yeah.
It was, man, because like I never had an off period of being told what to do or when to do from the time I was a kid to like that moment.
Yeah.
Right. And so you finally have this sense of freedom. And it's just like, what better thing to do than get a Volkswagen bus and drive around the country with a bride to be, you know? And it was cool, man, because you got to see different things, met all these incredible people. I had a typewriter in the back, so I'd just be like clacking away in my typewriter in the nighttime, just like being, you know, Jack Kerouac.
A glass of whiskey and a cigar.
Yeah, man, it was good. But that was me processing the war. You know, some people go for long walks. Some people do whatever. And for me, I just traveled around the country. That's what I needed to do. I needed to see how other people lived, you know? And I think that allowed me to understand myself better, right? Mm. So.
And would you consider yourself healed after that?
No. Fuck no.
Okay.
So all of these things, I mean, all of these things essentially led her and I to getting together. And that's when we had our first garden, right? And at that point was when that made sense, you know? So I started to put my hands into the soil, and there's just a moment that clicked. And that's when I realized, like, this is the next part of my life. Mm. And I started to feel like a sense of purpose at that point.
Okay.
Making the paper, traveling around, it was great. You help people heal, go through their shit, whatever. But for me, even though there were service involved with that, that wasn't what my service felt like I needed to be doing. And so I started teaching people how to garden and farm and raise animals and set up their homesteads. And at that point was when things actually got a little bit better, because in healthy soil, there's bacteria that triggers release of serotonin when you absorb it through your pores. I didn't know this at the time, but I realized that anytime I felt bad and I would be in the garden, I'd just take off my feet, take off my shoes, put my feet in the ground, and start to feel like this sense of belonging. And it's really magical. I mean, very whimsical word to say, but it's like in a magical moment that was happening, where you're engaging with this life force like that exists everywhere, dude. Mm-hmm. You look at a tree and you see the trunk, you see the branches and the leaves, but you don't realize that 2/3 of the biomass is actually underneath the ground, interacting with every other plant species that's in that area.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. And so you're just kind of developing and nurturing this relationship with this thing that quite literally provides you life.
Yeah.
And so that's when I started to find a difference and was able to work through like the signs and symptoms of post-traumatic stress. But at that point, I still hadn't really addressed the brain injuries.
Mm.
Okay.
And so we had a moment in 2015 where she was kind of nudging things my way, and I finally just like broke down and clacked away at the computer and started researching TBIs. And it was just like, that's when it like really started to affect me, that like I need to fix this, because the post-traumatic stress you can deal with. I think that's a lot easier thing to deal with.
Yeah.
But the physiological changes that occur during blast injuries is, they still don't know what all the impact that is.
Yeah.
And all of us have been around way too many of them. Right. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is newer science. I mean, it's more common science, I should say, right? We've known about this for years. But those two in compound are dangerous together.
Very.
You can't overcome post-traumatic stress if you don't address the TBI. And that's what we're finding now, is like, we got to address the brain injury first, you know, because that's going to throw off your biochem no matter what.
Yeah. The Venn diagram is weighted, right? Mm-hmm. You have to start with step one before you get to step two. The Venn diagram of TBI and PTSD, they share a whole lot of signs and symptoms.
Yep.
There's a lot of different ways to approach both of them, but if you don't address the first one, the second one's never going to get better.
Yeah, dude, right? If you don't get to the root cause, you're just wasting your time.
Yeah. Yep. We talked to Doc G and Doc Eisenman from Resiliency Brain Health about that pretty extensively, about the addressing of TBI, and I know you're talking to them as well.
And that's actually why I'm here in Texas, is because I heard them on your guys' podcast, and shortly thereafter recognized that I've had, you know, a bunch of head injuries since then, since 2006.
Okay.
And the most recent one, most severe one, was a year and a half ago. And that was a pretty intense one. And so from there, like the laws of compounding, right? Yeah. All the things that were never addressed from 2006 up into that point just blew up exponentially. Mm-hmm. And was at a point where, another point where it's just like, if I don't do something now, like I'm getting closer to that edge and I don't want to be at that edge.
Yeah.
And so I had reached out to them and they said, hey, we'll get a spot for you. Come on in. And dude, I've been going through the Resiliency Brain Health Program for the last week and like 2 hours of therapy and I'm exhausted. You know, it's because your brain is actually learning how to function again, how to like wake up and like acknowledge the body and that the body exists and that, yeah, just building that connection, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a huge, huge piece that's really important is as we age, we get more and more disconnected with our bodies, right?
Absolutely.
Oddly enough. And, you know, some of these great modalities out there are to swing that pendulum back and reach equilibrium again.
Sure.
So finding that balance is so important. So can you talk a little bit about your experience with the therapy and, you know, what you've come to expect, what you didn't even realize was the potential of it, and how you're feeling now?
Yeah, so we're on the break from our first week. I head back up there tonight, and then Monday we hit it harder than what we did this last week. And so I knew that things weren't firing right. I didn't know how. I didn't know what that meant entirely. I just knew that there's a disconnection, you know, where in a moment of like overwhelming, I can just feel my brain just kind of like shut down. Mm. And for a while, it's just like, am I making this up in my head? Is this actually happening? And no, it's not. Like, it's actually the body just and the brain protecting itself. It's telling you that like, hey, I don't have enough energy to continue doing the thing that you want me to do. So I'm going to shut down to preserve energy, to preserve you. Mm. And for me, having them explain that to me in the ways that they did was just light bulb after light bulb going off. Mm. And so one of the therapies that we're doing is the transcranial magnetic therapy, where it just sends it's like a concentrated MRI magnet that goes into your brain. And that kind of just says, hey, wake up and wake up and wake up. You know, and so they have different patterns for each side of the brain, depending on what it needs. And you can, you know, after sitting in that chair for, you know, 5-10 minutes, like you can feel your brain just acting in ways that are different. Mm. And then you go through and you go on the vibration plate. And it's just like, well, how is a vibration plate gonna fix your brain, oh, right?
So interesting.
Yes.
The vibration plates, yes.
But the logic behind it is that it's like your brain is then understanding that there's a body underneath it. Mm-hmm. And like you're feeling it. And so you take off your shoes, you go on this vibrating plate for 10 minutes and you're leaning your pressure back and forth.
You should put like a pot of soil on there and then just really...
Yeah, dude, we'll crunchy this thing up.
Yeah. So interesting stuff about the vibe plates too is, you know, your body obviously has this sheath around it called fascia.
Yes.
And as you hyper-vibrate your entire body, the toxins like essentially shake loose.
Yeah.
And that's why you have to drink a shitload of water after those treats.
Yeah, water and electrolytes, man.
That's it.
It's a really powerful thing. And then we started getting IV transfusions from, so like the NAD, which is just bag of niacin.
Perfect, yeah.
Yeah.
And dude, we had one guy in our group, he got the 400 cc's of it. Mm-hmm. And he was straight laying on the floor for like 2 hours. Because the niacin goes to where the inflammation is. So everybody reacts to this differently. But it's just really interesting to see how we're all going through these same therapies. We've all been through different circumstances that are somewhat rooted in the same thing.
Sure.
And we're all reacting to it differently.
Yeah.
And it's just, and so it's, for me, it kind of goes back to, we have to approach mental health, physical health, spiritual health from a multifaceted approach if we're going to continue to live and exist and move forward.
Yeah.
So...
And you had to have seen somewhere along the path of your recovery that you wanted to showcase this to other people who are dealing with the same struggles, I'm sure, right? So when within this whole process, because I know you've been doing this for a while, way beyond today, is talk about how you started. You know, you're getting out into the woods and, you know, bringing people out and the farming that you do.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that and how that complemented these therapies for yourself.
Sure. So, I mean, I grew up in the Boy Scouts, you know, so tying knots, building fires, playing with knives, all that stuff's been a part of me for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Right before COVID happened, I started getting back into going out and just having a fire.
Okay.
You know, not with any specific intention, just doing a different method to build that fire. And then that led back into building shelters, different tarp configurations, different debris huts, and so on and so forth. And then COVID happened, and then I had a whole bunch of time to just sit and just train in that way. Mm. And by this point, I had already gotten back into like fitness stuff, you know, training for like tactical two-gun competitions and stuff like that. Okay. But the field craft, the bushcraft part of it, like, it just resonated with me, and it brought me back to this place where, you know, back to the garden where I touched the soil and something clicked. And so for here, it's just like going back to when I was a lot younger and was able to connect with the wooded area in a different way than what I had previously. And so started really getting into like primitive skills and traditional tools, and, you know, and got to a point where, you know, my skill set was back up. I felt comfortable with it. People were asking me about it because they knew I was interested. So I just started teaching. Okay. And I've been doing that now for almost 5 years.
Mm. Wow.
And so nice. That kind of, you know, the birth of Accipiter Fieldcraft came probably two years ago. It became like an official thing. I was just helping this other guy, Jeff, with his school down in Massachusetts and kind of doing some stuff locally. But for me, fieldcraft, bushcraft, the whole survival thing, like these are all skills that we had. Like our ancestors had these, you know, even just two generations ago, it was more common, you know, within our lives. But it's a challenge, man. Fire, building a fire with limited resources will humble you very, very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you have these men and these women who at one point they wore a uniform, they did all these, you know, noble things. They get out, they struggle with emotions, and all of a sudden you give them a ferro rod and a piece of tinder and say, start a fire and make it last for 5 minutes and boil this water in the process, right? And you see them struggle, and then you give them a little glint of like wisdom, and they make that adjustment, and then all of a sudden they're doing the thing and they lighten up. Mm. You know, I've watched so many people get their first bow drill ember for the first time. And that to me is one of the most rewarding things, because like perfect conditions, you can get a bow drill ember within like 15 seconds. That doesn't mean like making the set, but you have to teach these people how to make the set. And then you have to add the elements from the environment and all these things. And then you have to add emotion too, right? Because it's really frustrating when you're trying to do the thing and you can't do the thing because the spindle keeps popping out, right?
Yeah.
And so you have to teach them to control their breathing. You have to teach them how to control their posture, and like they're engaging their core and they're doing all the things with their body that they should have been doing all along. And you're just doing that through survival skills, wilderness living skills, you know, and it's pretty awesome to see vets and first responders do that for the very first time.
I can imagine it changes a lot
for sure.
In their outlook. I mean, giving them just a small challenge like that to overcome, that's got to light a spark of itself.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, in Vermont, I spend a lot of time outside. You know, that's one of my favorite places to be. I don't mind the winters. I don't mind, you know, the negative teen wind chills, all that. I don't, you know, that's for me, that's another day of training, right?
Sure.
But there's so many people that visit and they go outside, and they don't have any kind of thing to get them through a night if they need to. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, the motto of the Boy Scouts is be prepared. Mm-hmm. And that's something like I've taken to heart throughout the entirety of my life. But if you're going outside, know how to build a fire, know how to do it without a lighter, know how to put up a shelter, because like nature doesn't care about you. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't. And it'll swallow you up really quickly.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and so what's the longest stint that you've been out alone?
Personally alone?
Mm-hmm. Have you seen that show Alone, speaking of?
Yeah.
Dope.
Yeah.
Personally alone, three, four days.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Self-sustained for 11 days. And nice. The plan is this year we're going to be running some classes. This year we'll be running some classes to where it's longer term, and the idea is at the end of it is to have people out there for 3 to 4 days by themselves.
Okay.
So I'm not going to put people through things that I wouldn't do myself.
Yeah.
So I'm going to double that and like start to take away resources. You know, I feel comfortable doing that. Sleep deprivation is not an issue. Food deprivation is not an issue. But knowing how to manage those things when you're trying to complete a certain task is the issue. Mm-hmm. Like, can you stay sharp and do the thing? Mm-hmm. So the idea with the class is to get people to that point. But in order to do so, I got to make sure I'm still up to speed.
Sure.
So I'll challenge myself. Like, it'll be downpouring rain, and I'll challenge myself to go out and just build a fire with just a ferro rod. Mm-hmm. Right. So how are you going to do that? There's an order of operation. But for me, you know, family life is really important, and to take extended periods of time away from that is difficult. Mm-hmm. Especially I tell my wife, hey, I'm going to go out by myself in the woods for like 6 days. You cool with that? You know? Yeah. And she would be. Kathy, man, she's a rock star, you know?
But so, why? You know, yeah. But why? Because you're right. After 3-4 days, you're pretty solid. Like, if you could do it for three days, I mean, not to say you're doing it for a month, but
yeah.
At least 3 days is a, I mean, that's every bug out individual's dream, right? Is to survive 3 days in the wild.
Yeah. And it's not an issue, man. It's just, you know, I'm out doing something every day.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just like being able to take the time away. And for me, I could take the time away to do like the resiliency brain program right now, mm-hmm. because that's necessary. Like, going out to the woods for 5 days by myself isn't necessary on the longer term. But my wife and my kids, they all do this stuff with me. You know, they're, you know, my kids been playing with sharp things since they're like 3 years old. They both know how to make fires with ferro rods.
Wow.
You know, whenever we process animals on the farm, they're right there with me. You know, and so it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Let's talk about the farm side of things as well.
Yep. Wild Roots Community Farm. So we are a 10-acre operation dedicated to community resilience through food systems education and wilderness living skills. It started off in 2014 as a small 2.5-acre plot of land. And I started working with the veteran community, bringing them out there to teach them how to grow food, build soil health, do all the things that are really important to actually create nutrient-dense food.
Sure.
Right? Started working with colleges and universities, and we realized that we need a little bit more space. And so, we found this 10.5-acre parcel back in 2016, moved onto it and started planting trees, started preparing for rotational grazing in a silvopasture, which is essentially just animals that rotate through trees. They do all the pasture management for us. So that cuts down on the usage of fossil fuels for mowing. They actually have a really healthy palette of food because we frost seed and we put this, you know, diverse cocktail of forage crops in there. So they're constantly being fed, you know, really nutrient dense grass. Mm. Sorry, we can geek out on this for a long time.
Gotta be the best meat ever.
it's incredible.
Yeah.
So I got a buddy, he's a James Beard winning baker.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with that, it's a very prestigious award for being really good at what you do in a kitchen. And we were doing a on-farm slaughter workshop. So we had like a dozen and a half people there. We had a big pig hanging. I sit there, I cut out the liver, I hand it to Zachary. It's like, hey man, here you go. And he already had a cast iron pan going. He chopped up the liver, threw it in there, used a hand crank grinder, made pate, and he comes back around the corner. He's like, dude, I could taste the apples. And for me, that was like a huge measure of success because like our pigs, they get apples, apple cider vinegar, and beer every day. Mm. Or, you know, they cycle through that. But that's I know all the things that go into my animals.
Yeah.
Right.
I know what
it is. Yeah. And you have that connection with your food, and like you become a healthier person because of it.
Yeah.
You're not taking for granted, you know, what it took to put a plate in front of you, mm-hmm. right? Not everyone has that connection. So that's why we have the farm, is to help people build that connection themselves. And for a vegan to say, yeah, I'll eat your eggs. And for a vegetarian to say, yeah, I'll eat your chicken. That to me is like a measure of success.
Absolutely. Right?
Because they see the process. They see what food systems can look like. They see mm-hmm. how we engage with that process.
And it's from the top down.
Yeah, man.
I mean, you guys are cultivating the food that these animals eat as well. Can you talk, I'm sure you have a plethora of knowledge on some of the things that we find in our local grocery stores. And, you know, I'm sure that you know, we've sucked all the nutrients out of these like plants that we're selling, these vegetables and fruits, right? Do you know, like, are you familiar with like some of the techniques they utilize and some of the scary things, I guess?
Yeah. So the majority of tomatoes, if they're not local, when they get picked, they're picked green and they're sprayed with a chemical. Mm-hmm. So that way, by the time they get to you, they're red. So it kind of like slows down the ripening process. But before that, there's every other herbicide, pesticide, fungicide that goes into the soil, which depending on who you talk to and what their involvement is with the industry, they're going to say, oh, well, it's not going to uptake those things, but that's not true. They do uptake those things.
For years.
Yes.
For years. Yes. So even like organic, even organic farming, yes, has pesticides that have been in the soil because there's it's a certain amount of time. Like, is it like 7 years between you can dictate it's organic?
It depends on the state and depends on the certification process. Mm-hmm. I don't recall what it is for Vermont, but it's somewhere around 7 years, if I'm not mistaken, where it has to be in organic production for that amount of time before you actually can get certified.
And then like the soil stays tainted for like 20 years.
Yeah, that stuff lasts
like 15 years.
It lasts a minute.
Well, there's a topsoil issue right now, right? I mean, we're talking about like 60 crops left or 60 years worth of crops left at the radar curtain. Topsoil is bleeding out its nutrition.
Yeah. So
like I hear that suggested all the time. That's scary.
So every time you turn over the topsoil releases the soil carbon. And then what you're also doing is you're also undoing the integrity of the soil, of the thing that holds the soil together, right? Yeah. That's that organic biomass. And those are the things that they break down, they cycle nutrients, they store water, they store the little beneficial bacteria and all the things that you actually need to have a living soil.
Yeah.
So one of the best things that you can actually do in your garden is just put some hay, straw, or wood chips on top of it, because that's going to protect the actual aggregate of the soil and the integrity of it and not let it turn to dirt. So there's small solutions that you can do that have a lasting impact. And for us,
and this was like the Dust Bowl, right?
Oh
like
yeah. That's what happened. Cause you had, there's like 14 feet of like nutrient rich topsoil in the plains that just got turned over and they lost it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's from, you know, however many years of animals rotating through there. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what we do at Wild Roots is like, we mimic that. We biomimic that. Mm. So we rotate our animals on a cycle. We don't let it get overgrazed, which allows it doesn't shock the plant. And then when the grasses come back, they're fuller. You know, it's a really wonderful thing to watch that process take place and unfold.
Yeah, absolutely. So is your farm considered a regenerative farm?
Yeah, we're regenerative. We don't have like the certification. But it's essentially just a small scale agroforestry system.
Okay. I think that's an amazing process. I've listened to White Oak Pastures talk about that a few times on a few different podcasts, and I love what they're doing. I mean, they have the system down, which apparently is an ancient system about how we used to run our crops and our farms to where they're actually carbon negative.
That's awesome.
Which is surprising. I mean, the fact that, you know, you have these dairy farms that are, you know, pushing out an abundant amount of carbon, but if you're able to reuptake that and create more nutrient dense soil at the same time, and still farm, like, why are we not doing this everywhere?
Oh well, you know? That's money.
That's a big thing.
Yeah, well, I know. I understand doing it at scale is very difficult, but you know, if you had,
well, I agree with you. I mean, listen, we should. What are some, like, from your perspective? What are some quick and easy things that we could implement that would help with our American agriculture and farming?
Yeah, is there something we can do?
Yeah, plant trees, cover your soil, introduce fungi. So like Strepharia, it's like a burgundy-colored portobello type, but it's a saprophytic mushroom. So its main job is to break down organic material and make nutrients bioavailable for bacteria and for the next succession of mushrooms to come up. You do those things and like you will increase your soil health very rapidly. Like compost, like don't overwater, only water where you need to. And that's really the big thing. On a small scale.
Yeah, very basic then.
It's small solutions have a lasting impact. So
Dave, you asked a question earlier and I don't want to not tell this because you asked, are there any crazy things that we might want to hear about?
So the other so the tomatoes is a big thing. Like everything gets sprayed pretty heavily, even the organic stuff. There's gray areas. Like there are certain things that they can use on the fungicide and pesticide level. But the eggs typically are like 42 days old when you get them in the store.
On average.
Yeah, on average.
Up to 6 months.
That's horrible.
Disgusting. From the time that they're laid to the time that you're purchasing them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous.
And so for me, it's just like, well, grow your own food. You know,
yeah. if have you a can't, couple chickens.
Yeah, have a couple chickens, like have just like a patio garden. Like you can do small things and, you know, you might not be having your full diet come from something that you cultivated, but like
and you're the GMO issue as well.
It's a real thing, man.
Genetically modified to give you the best look,
yeah,
but takes out all of the good nutrients to it. You know?
Yep. And the argument can be made, well, nature naturally genetically modifies things. And yes,
which
sure.
Which is bullshit. You know what size the average apple is? Like
much smaller.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
Crab we have, apple.
Yep.
Yeah. They're very, very small. It's wild to me. And then you get this big jumbo yeah. with no nutrients at all in it.
Yeah.
It's just sugar.
Yes.
Mm. Golly.
It's so crazy stuff. Yeah. It is crazy. But like if we're going back to like mental health and physical health, we are what we eat. Mm. Like the studies have shown the connection between the stomach biome and your brain health.
Absolutely.
Right. And so if we're filling ourselves with junk every day, like it's no reason why we wouldn't be feeling like crap in the head.
You're also going to crave junk.
Yes.
If you continue to eat junk, because
that's so true.
Your flora is used to that. It's yep. going, that's where you get your cravings is from is your gut
why,
lining.
Is that why I always have to have more than one piece of carrot cake?
That's just me.
Fatty. So I'm very interested as well is you've created such a unique facility in that it's kind of like 100% like top down. Like I said, every avenue you're thinking of, you must have the conversations with, you mentioned it, vegans and vegetarians quite often. And I think that there is a massive miscommunication, no education at all
yeah.
on farming in general, right? You have like, how many conversations you have is like, well, I can't believe that you would, you know, kill animals, but yeah. yet we have avocado farms that just massacre all the wildlife.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. 27,000 animals die for every...
Per acre, right?
Yeah, per acre.
Per acre.
It's like, you want to yell at me, like,
crop, yeah.
processing, like, raising my pig and processing it myself, but, like, that tofu block you just bought, like, how many bunnies were killed in the process of making that?
Thousands, yeah. hundreds of thousands for the tofu.
So, like, if it's an ethical thing, I have no problem with that. Like, I get it. Like, you don't want to eat meat because you don't want to eat meat. It's a living creature. Whatever. You do.
I totally get, too. Yeah. I don't want to eat it. Because I don't know where it's been.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't want to go to the local HEB.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, then you go on Instagram and you see like worms coming out of it and stuff. And you're like, what do I eat?
Well, that, and like, yeah. we've seen the chicken trucks driving around. Like, everyone's seen chicken trucks driving around, the Tyson trucks, where these, you got a chicken in like a 10 by 10 by 10 inch box where they're stuffed in there. And these things are so fat that they're like spilling out the ports on the sides of these boxes. That's. Yeah. Horrendous conditions. Can you imagine what you're putting in your body? Yeah. Like the chemicals that are being released in that poor animal, the poor animal is being brutalized its entire life, and then it gets killed for you to eat it. You can't be eating anything healthy.
No. And, like, and we
that
we
has
know.
To carry through.
We it know does. Stress.
Yeah.
We know stress yep. affects meat.
Yeah. If yeah. it affects the flavor, it affects the content. Like it has to.
I yeah. mean,
that's why you surprise kill pigs, right?
Yeah. I mean, our
that's
pigs.
The whole you have to.
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole reason.
Our pigs are pretty chill when they go out,
yeah.
you know, and that's, you know, I'm not like laying like flower wreaths on their heads and shit, but you know, it's like,
how many friends do they have? Yeah. Do they have names?
They do have names, but we try to go like a theme each year. So one year we did baked goods. This year we have Star Wars.
Okay.
You know, spices, stuff
Pig
like
Solo.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
fun play on names.
Yeah. We have Chewie and Han Solo right now. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man! Well, I think it's beautiful what you're doing, and it's a classy way of doing it too. It's just kind of falling back to that primal methodology, really.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, any last minute kind of things that we missed on covering?
Yeah, endurance racing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the other side of it, you know, we were talking about this on the hike today, is that. If you make these small lifestyle changes, you're going to have a huge impact on your life, mm-hmm. right? So diet, sleep, exercise. We all spend too much time thumbing around. Like I absolutely do it as well. You know, we largely consume food that might not be the healthiest, But like the other side of that is getting out and just moving your bodies, right? Yeah. And so a couple years ago, right after the pandemic, like I was in a bad spot, not because of the pandemic, but I think it's just like all the head injury stuff was compounding. Mm. And I got into a bad place and I saw my buddy was in this tactical two-gun competition. And I was like, well, fuck it, I guess I'll do that. Mm. And so that put me back into a place of fitness. And I started recognizing the, you know, the impact I was having on my head, on my health, all these things, which led one thing to another, started doing, you know, like 12-hour races, you know, longer stuff. And then one of my buddies, who's from Vermont, him and another buddy, they were together in the 160th. We all formed this adventure race team. Mm. So Flow State Endurance. And the idea is that we're building, you know, we have the camaraderie to push ourselves through like really difficult stuff. We, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, we just did a 350-mile race from the Gulf Coast of Florida all the way to the Atlantic Coast of Florida. Multidiscipline, looking for land nav points, had 3 hours of sleep along the way. So we were paddling. We had two like 20-plus mile paddles. You know, wow. One of them was open ocean. One was in a river in the nighttime, you know, like mountain biking and trekking, right? But we were doing that because we're raising funds for this organization in the Hudson Valley called Guardian Revival. And Guardian Revival, they take veterans and first responders, and they have a couple different programs that they use. The Boots and Paws, they're hooking these people up with service dogs. Mm-hmm. They have Encore, so they're teaching them how to write music, make music. They have the G-Connect, which is a peer-to-peer thing. And then they have another summit, which is getting folks outside. And that's part of where I come in, because I've been, you know, teaching them survival stuff for this last year. But they brought us on as like Guardian champions. So they're sponsoring us to do some of this stuff. And in turn, we raise money for them. But what's really cool about this organization is that a lot of the people that they work with from New York were ground zero during 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, like one of the guys who pulled the chief of FDNY out of the rubble is in this group. You know, another one of the guys who, he was a detective NYPD who worked the landfill area looking for remains is in this group. And like some of the other folks that are there, just absolutely incredible. And so Alex Othmer, he's a former SEAL, started this organization. And they bring on people who are just wanting to do hard things mm-hmm. and like not fail, not quit, just keep driving forward. And so, yeah, Flow State Endurance is our race team. And it's just, we're just three dumbasses who like self-induced suffering.
Highly and, doubt and doing, dumbasses, for sure.
And doing so for a good cause, though. And yeah. that's why we're beautiful, doing it, man, you know.
You endurance athletes are another animal.
It's a different type of stupidity, for sure.
It's a different type of suck, dude. That's sure a different type of suck, yeah.
Well, it's amazing, like, the journey that you've been on and really just to highlight on focus of mental health and you know, coming back to your roots, really.
Yeah, for sure.
So beautiful stuff. Where can we find you at?
So the only social I have is Instagram, and it's the_fieldcraft_farmer. You can probably find it through Sipiter Fieldcraft as mm-hmm. well. And then that'll link to our page, Wild Roots Community Farm. Mm-hmm. And then Flow State Endurance is just Flow State Endurance. Mm-hmm. So, and those are three ways you can find us.
It's going to be beautiful, too. I'm sure you that you have a huge vision for the future of what this looks like. And I'm sure, you know, training videos and stuff like that. I know
for sure
we have talked about maybe incorporating you into our world with Terra Arma to do these kind of things, too.
I'd absolutely love to do that. I love your clothing. And that's like legit. That's not just a plug for you guys right now because you're sitting in front of me.
We got a gun on him right now. Tell us one more time.
My wife loves your clothing.
And all your boys wear them.
And they do. Absolutely do. So it's good stuff. But I think that what you guys are doing, both your philosophy behind Terra Arma, but then what you're doing with the podcast is saving lives. Like 100% without a doubt is saving lives. And I know there's times when I get in a funk and I'll throw you guys on and I'll just listen. Because for me, it's like someone else is telling a story. I can relate. I can't relate. But it's just like that's them processing. And I think that that's a powerful thing to bear witness to. So I appreciate you guys having me on. I appreciate everything that you do for our communities and all the blessings to you in that process.
We echo the sentiments. So. Yeah, you're a truly inspirational person, John. Like I really admire what you guys are doing. I admire the direction and the fact that you're not giving in.
Fuck no, man.
We're going to do it the right way, and it's the only way to do it.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate that.
Absolute pleasure getting to know you too, and this is just the start of our adventures together. So
hell yeah.
I'm sure that I'll be one of those guys that are throwing things across the room for my first flame under a snowstorm in the middle of the night
while John's kids in the middle outshine you. like, come on, old man.
Can't blame it on the leg this time. All right, brother. Well, thanks again for coming on. Been an absolute pleasure, and we're looking forward to seeing you in the future.
Same. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, John. This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us today. If you want to get in touch or learn more, head on over to medevacpodcast.com, M-E-D-E-V-A-C, or hit us up on Instagram because that's the easiest way to see the updates, and there's going to be a lot more going on this year. So get involved at Medevac Podcast. Go follow it right now.
And if you're interested in coming out to one of our local TAC hikes for Terra Arma, you'll find that information on our Instagram as well.
Yep, right over there. See you next week.
Until next time.
Bye.